Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people's stories and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for the next hour, Saquon Gatlin, and I want to thank you for joining us for this July 2nd edition of the show. Coming up on today's show, we have the 7-day weather forecast and news from around the state. Keith Morgan of Story County Emergency Management is here to discuss what Story County has done to manage the floods. Hear from him after the news. Also, we'll hear an interview with Dr. Carver Nebbe about the rising suicide rates and the links between self-care and mental health. At the end of the program, Councilwoman Bronwyn Beattie Hansen will join me for a conversation about the city's recent council decisions. Stay tuned. This is Local Talk. I hope you have your shades and shorts ready for the 7-day forecast. You'll need them most of this week. For the first time in 3 weeks, you won't need your umbrella on a Monday. Isn't that awesome? The sky is clear and the sun is shining bright today. If you're out and about right now, you'll feel the low of 62 degrees. That won't last for long as we get into the afternoon. The high is 86. Tomorrow, the clouds will come back, but don't fear the rain quite yet. There's a 10% chance of precipitation on Tuesday with a high of 87 and a low of 70 degrees. If Tuesday's weather forecast is Mary Kate, Wednesday is Ashley. On Thursday, scattered thunderstorms make a thunderous return. Expect the rain to peak from noon to 2 p.m. This weekend, the sun returns with a bright smile. The high for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday is hovering around 85 degrees. And that's all we have for your weather report this morning. Cities around the state of Iowa have experienced fatal flooding after last weekend's rain. According to the National Weather Service, the Des Moines metro area saw constant thunderstorms this weekend, resulting in nearly half a foot of rain. An Iowan sportscaster was found dead several blocks away from his vehicle after floodwaters swept him into a creek. On Sunday morning, 66-year-old Larry Kotler died on the north side of Des Moines near 50th Street and Twana Drive. Authorities reported his van was severely flooded. He serviced the Drake University community as a play-by-play announcer for the men's basketball team since 2005. Kotler is survived by his wife and two sons. Iowa City police are investigating an armed robbery on Sunday morning involving multiple suspects. Two victims called the police early yesterday morning about a group of men assaulting the two and stealing one of their personal property. Both were injured during the assault, but medical attention was not needed. The victims say a white Suburban or Yukon-like SUV pulled up to them on the 400 block of South Clinton Street. Six men shouted at the two before jumping out of the vehicle and assaulting the victims. Iowa City Crime Stoppers are offering a $1,000 reward for information about the crime. Children at a Des Moines hospital received a super surprise outside their windows. Window washers dressed up as superheroes and cleaned windows at Blanks Children's Hospital. Employees from Larry's Window Service wore Batman, Spider-Man, Flash, and Captain America costumes as they hung from the outside of the building with their window wipers. The heroes drew pictures on the windows as the children smiled while touching the glass. This is the third year that Larry's Window Service employees wore costumes on the job at the hospital. Earlier, I mentioned the flooding in the Des Moines metro area, which have been considered at historic levels. DSM is not the only area to witness heavy flooding. Did you get a chance to see the Brookside Parks and how they looked about last week? The skate park across the street filled more than halfway up the ramps. Ames has experienced heavy rainfall over the past few weeks, resulting in serious flooding. I wanted to speak with someone about what is being done on the issue. Therefore, I asked a man who handles emergencies in Story County to speak with us this morning about the flood concerns. Keith Morgan is the Emergency Management Coordinator at Story County Emergency Management. He joins me in the studio. Thank you for coming in this morning, Keith, and welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
Can you explain what areas in Story County have been affected by flooding?
Well, on June 14th, we had quite a bit of rain here in Ames and also down in the city of Kelly. Ames did experience some damages during that initial wave of water, and Kelly actually had quite a bit of water that stayed in the city after the rain had passed, and we spent about a week trying to find a way to get the water up out of Kelly and to get the western part of Kelly drained so that things could return back to normal. And then, as you saw last weekend on Saturday, although most of the attention was focused down on Ankeny, and rightfully so, the city of Maxwell also experienced something similar to what Ames and Kelly had experienced, with a lot of water coming down and it overwhelming the infrastructure.
Now, what exactly does the city do to manage flooding?
Well, the process in emergency management flows all the way from what we call mitigation, which is to try and predict where our risks are at and to try and make it so that we mitigate those risks by either making it so the event doesn't happen, which is pretty much impossible when it comes to flash flooding, through taking protective measures to reduce the impact of those. Then when we go from there into preparation, making sure that we can respond to it when the time does come, to make sure that people are safe and to try and get them out of the way of the floodwaters, on into that actual response, which is, as you've seen before, first responders going out, and if people do become trapped, to try and free them or get them out of the way of the water. Also warning the public so that they can avoid that hazard. And we try and capture as much information both during the response and immediately after the response, which is the recovery phase that we're in right now, so that we can move back into that mitigation phase and look and see where did the damages occur, what kind of emergency events happened, so that we can try and take measures to, again, prevent those.
Now, couple weeks ago, I think it was 2 weeks ago, you were on with the Rapids Action Team. So did they need to be involved in any of this at all in the last recent situations?
We didn't have a need for sheltering. That's one of the aspects that we could do, is that if, as you've seen down in Ankeny, there's apartments that are have become flooded, so our rats would be a part of that response. They've evacuated those apartments. We would find a place to shelter them, and we would use our rats. One of the main things that we've been trying to do during this flooding period is to get the word out to people where the flooding is occurring so that they can avoid it or take protective measures on their own inside their house. So as a part of emergency management, we're watching these storms as they roll through. On our Facebook page, we try and keep people informed where the flash flood warnings are and severe thunderstorm warnings are, so that they can take their own protective measures, such as making sure that if they have any of their stuff that's down in basements, to go ahead and try and get it elevated, and also if they're out driving, to avoid those areas where there has been flash flooding in the past. A lot of times folks will know where not to go. The Grand Avenue is the one that always floods under that underpass. It's a place to avoid if you hear that there's heavy rains.
Now, as a citizen, it can be pretty dangerous during the flooding. As you've seen, there have been a couple examples in surrounding areas where people actually have lost their lives in these situations. What can us normal, regular citizens do to be more informed, other than like just checking the Facebook page? Or when should we know if it's not safe to be out and about?
Well, first off, you're really going to know because you're going to see this heavy rain coming down. And we always talk about it in the wintertime. Is it really worth it to go out when we're having this kind of a weather event that's out there? especially at night, water over the road is difficult to see. So, again, make that that decision based on, is it worth it? If nothing else, is it worth it for me to have my car get flooded and damaged like that? If you do have to go out, again, most of us will know those low-lying areas in our neighborhoods where we're driving at. Once you get close to one of those, take it slow and easy. And if you start to get in water, don't risk it. Don't think that it's just a couple inches of water. I hear it all the time talking to people that have been affected by it. I just thought it was a couple inches of water. And as they got deeper and deeper, I heard one person talking about a pickup truck floating. You wouldn't think that that can happen, but the buoyancy and also the force of water, especially when it's moving quickly, can make it so that your vehicle is doing things that you never thought it would do. And then now you're stuck out in the water, and you can't get back, and that's where it really becomes dangerous.
Yeah, we definitely don't want anyone to experience these dangers in flash floods. So we want to make sure that everyone is protected. What other areas in Ames specifically do you know that have flooded? I know that the Brookside Park was a pretty big thing that happened a couple weeks ago. What other areas did you know of?
A lot of it was along the drainage areas. We've also had flooding in the northeast side of Ames in the past. We seem to be getting very, very localized heavy rain that overwhelms the infrastructure out there. So that area has received it. A lot of it was up along Stang, on the northern part of Ames where it came down pretty heavily. But again, that's where that rain fell. The problem with flash flooding as opposed to river flooding is you don't know where exactly is going to be impacted next. So everybody has to assume that it is going to impact them. It's also little things like we have these egress windows now. A lot of people are using their basements in ways never as we didn't in the past. And we're having a lot more where the water will flow over the surface and into these egress windows and down into the basements. So that's something to be aware of.
Can you describe that a little bit more for me? I've never heard of the egress windows before.
If you have a living space down in your basement, you now have to have a window that people can use to escape should there be a fire, which is, again, we're balancing risk like we all often have to do within emergency management. So you now have this window that is low down in essentially in a well that is below surface area, and the water flows across the surface, goes down into those wells that allow people enough room to get out the window and up and out. Well, it's a perfect holding tank for water that will eventually pop out a window and allow water to flow into the basements.
Wow. Well, then maybe we should make some more investments into these egress windows just to prepare for some of these floods. Now, the creek, I was walking to the station this morning, and the creek that's near, it's going north to south, that's near University Boulevard and Lincoln Way, it looks like it's still pretty high. Do you know, like, what would be the estimated amount of time when that may get lower, or is that even a danger or a consideration for the emergency team?
Oh, sure. That's the Squaw Creek. And we have actually another thing that citizens can do. They can go on the National Weather Service site. The Squaw Creek and the Skunk River have got a series of flood gauges on them. And on Saturday night, you could watch the flood gauges go up, starting up to the northwest, up into Boone County, and you could just watch that pattern move on down through. It has crested. It is going down, and we hope that it does empty out as much as possible to provide us more capacity in the future.
Awesome. Is there anything else that you wanted to share with us about staying informed on any of the problems that could be around or that could be surrounding flooding at all in our area or in the surrounding Story County areas?
Sure. I was visiting with one family that did get flooded, and they weren't aware that you can get flood insurance even if you're not right next to a body of water. And again, with water flowing over the surface nowadays, I encourage people to check it out. If they've got any vulnerability to this kind of surface flash flooding, get that flood insurance. It'll actually be fairly inexpensive because because they're not right next to a body of water. And as long as the water comes from somewhere else and does impact them, then they have a chance to be able to recover much faster because they'll have the financial resources to do that. And again, just like you've been briefing the weather, keep an eye on the weather, especially if you're going to be traveling. But even if you're not traveling, always be watching that weather so that you can be aware of where there are risks. Like we said, people up in here named would not have suspected that Ankeny was getting as hit as hard as it was if they weren't watching the news.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank you, Keith, for coming in, and you gave us some great suggestions on how to stay safe and protected in the recent weather conditions that we have been experiencing. So egress windows it was, and then
flood insurance.
Yep. Okay. Awesome. Well, if you are just now tuning in with us, this is Local Talk on 89.1 KHOI FM Story County. I am your host, Saquon Gatlin, and we just heard from Keith Morgan from Story County Emergency Management about how the city manages floods and a couple protective methods that we can do as citizens to stay safe in harsh weather conditions. Thank you, Keith, for coming in.
Thank you.
Last month, fashion designer Kate Spade and chef Anthony Bourdain ended their lives. Since the event, the call rate to suicide hotlines increased. After hearing this, I was curious to understand if and how public figures committing suicide affects the general population. To get a better understanding of the situation, I contacted Dr. Carver Nebbe concerning high-profile suicides. Dr. Nebbe is a psychiatrist at the Thielen Health Center. He had a lot to share on the topic. He mentioned a popular Netflix television series titled 13 Reasons Why that began airing in 2017. The show is about a young girl who committed suicide in high school and left behind a set of cassette tapes on the 13 reasons why she killed herself. Dr. Nebbe detailed the concern of high-profile cases in media coverage on suicide.
The concern about the show is that it could be anitis for what we call a suicide contagion, where you might have an increase in suicides that are associated with popular depiction of suicides. The criticism of Netflix is that not only did it depict a suicide, it sort of romanticized it by having her inform the people who she blamed for her decision to commit suicide subsequently. And the show apparently proceeded to follow the discovery of those people when they were informed. Again, I didn't watch the show, and partly because I didn't feel that it was appropriate, given that we do have some evidence to suggest that there are such things as suicide contagion, particularly among the young and the old.
Interesting. Now, there was like these, it was 13 reasons left behind in the cassettes of why she killed herself. So that's kind of, what would be the contagion part then? Fear of that contagion?
A contagion would suggest that when people are exposed to media reports or news reports about a suicide, particularly when a suicide is seen to be glorified, or rather the person who did it is seen to be glorified, that you'll have what are known as copycat events, which occur among people a lot of times in the same age group or demographic. And so studies have shown that it seems to be people in younger age groups and people in older age groups, but not as much middle age, interestingly, who have been susceptible to it. There have been lots of studies on this issue, and some have shown, some have suggested about 5% of suicides over the course of the next year may be related to such events. The bigger concern, of course, is that throughout much of the United States, we've seen about a 30% increase in suicide in at least half of all the states over the past 20 years, since about 1999. And that's an interesting phenomenon. And there are multiple reasons that this could be the case, and we don't understand exactly why it's occurred.
Can you explain some of the reasons why someone may commit suicide?
So about half of all people who are noted to commit suicide have some known issue of mental health or some mental health problem. That could be depression, schizophrenia, other things. The difficulty, of course, is that mental health issues are not easily divided up into neat categories. The perplexing part is that about 50% of suicides aren't necessarily correlated to a known mental health condition. That is to say that the person who commits suicide didn't have a pre-existing condition that was known. They could be related certainly to financial problems, to relationship problems, to substance use or abuse. Some people definitely have had suicide events that are precipitated by acute intoxication, which might not have otherwise occurred. There are people who do it and never were known to have any kind of issues, and this is very perplexing. One of the problems with suicide is that it is something which occurs in a very short space of time. A person usually decides to do it, or it appears that a person will more frequently decide to do it and do it, and it will be over, and it's a very short period of time when people can intervene.
So you're saying that people may decide on this quickly, like there may not even be any warning signs to it?
In a certain percentage of suicides, that's absolutely the case. That said, what is the biggest predictor of an eventual suicide completion? And that is a previous suicide attempt. So we definitely have risk factors. We definitely know demographics, but it is still very difficult to predict who is going to do it and when and why and what will precipitate it. So it's a very hard issue. We certainly try very hard. One of the things that we do is certainly have short-term hospitalizations that where we take people when they have suicidal ideation. How effective is that? Well, we don't entirely know. We also know that it's very hard to attribute any success in prevention of suicide to the medications or interventions that we practice for mental health issues. There are only two medications where they say that there are definitive benefits in terms of suicide, and those are lithium and clozapine, a medication used for bipolar disorder, and the other one used for psychotic disorders or schizophrenia specifically.
What else is being done to support mental health, and what would you say is the state of our mental health systems in America?
We have a very difficult situation with mental health in the United States in general. I would say in Iowa in particular. We have an increasing number of mental health diagnoses, whether that is because of an increasing incidence or an increasing identification of mental health problems or an increased awareness. There are probably multiple factors that have increased the number of mental health interventions and diagnoses. The thing is, we have a relatively poor network or safety net for mental health issues. We have difficulty getting people into psychiatrists, for instance, on a timely basis. We have difficulty getting appointments exactly when people might need them. We have a relatively poor network of halfway houses and assertive community treatment programs to support those with serious mental illnesses. We have a lot of people who have mental health problems who essentially live in isolation and have almost no support. And that is a difficult situation. This is possibly partly due to the fact that we've had so much splintering of families. People have a tendency in the United States to live remotely from their families and live alone, where in other nations you have tighter family units. But I have to say, I don't know that that is a specific risk factor for mental health problems, but it certainly makes it harder to address.
So many different places, not knowing just what I'd find here. I've seen so many different faces, but they always stay so fresh in my mind. Some of them seem so lonely, trying to make it on their own, wondering where to turn to, knowing you can't make no blood out of stone.
That was You've Got the Power by Third World. You are listening to Local Talk on 89.1 KHOI Community Radio. We are hearing from the psychiatrist Dr. Nebbe informing us of the impact of high-profile suicides on the general public and the importance of self-care toward mental health. What is being done in the present to try to address these issues since they are coming up more than they have before in the past?
I think there are a lot of things that we are doing. Certainly one of the biggest things that we want to do is just have awareness for mental health problems and publicize the fact that there is help available, and also encourage people to help each other and not judge when they have, or when they learn about somebody with a mental health problem, but rather help. We have tried to make every effort to improve access to mental health resources. Certainly there is a wide network of different types of professionals who help with mental health problems. There are hotlines that people can access. There are some residential type programs and community programs where people can receive help. Although I would have to say that residential programs are one of the things that have been hit most hard by budget constraints and funding for mental health. Your basic family practitioner is somebody who is a great resource for mental health aid. And that's something that a lot of people don't recognize, that your primary care doctor is a good place to start. Some of them are very comfortable with mental health problems and some of them aren't, but they usually have some idea of how to access resources. Certainly crisis counselors, that are available on hotlines can help. Hospital emergency rooms are frequently a stop for those who have mental health problems. But to be honest, the emergency room is not a good place for people who have mental health problems either. They pose long waiting periods, a lot of confusion, high emotion, frustration, and it's always best to keep mental health out of the emergency room. Another fascinating element of our society is that a large number of the mental health or people suffering from mental health problems are now ending up in prisons. And to some degree, to a great degree, the prison systems are becoming the largest provider of mental health services in many places.
Wow, I did not know that. Wow, that's very interesting. It's kind of difficult to hear.
It's a difficult situation, though, because, I mean, it's good that the prison system has stepped up to provide mental health support, but it's certainly a failing that those people are ultimately having to get their mental health treatment in the prison system.
I wanted to discuss the link between self-care and the quality of mental health. Can you describe some of the elements of self-care and how that relates?
So my background is that I have training in both family medicine and in psychiatry. And what I tell most of my patients, what I tell all of my patients, really, and the caveat is that I practice more psychiatry than primary care. But what I tell all my patients is that the basis of mental and physical health comes down to what I call the three pillars of mental and physical health, and that is good regular sleep, a good regular diet, and regular exercise. That boils down to sleep, diet, and exercise in three words, and routine in one word. I would add to that also important are not smoking cigarettes, not using drugs, and not using alcohol to any appreciable degree. If you look at the evidence that's out there on these factors, and there has been a lot of evidence over the past 20 years that we can improve our health in many ways by the way that we take care of ourselves. Unfortunately, we live in a time when our lives are more and more sedentary. We move around a lot less. We sit a lot more. And that appears to be causing us a lot of problems, both physically and mentally. And there is evidence to suggest that taking care of yourself in this way not only is protective in terms of mental health, but definitely protective in terms of your physical health. A number of years ago, I read a commentary by one respected physician. I can't remember who it was at this time, but he conjectured that about 80% of chronic disease and cancer could be prevented through good self-care. Again, that's sleep, diet, exercise, not smoking, and minimal to no alcohol. And I thought, wow, that is an amazing claim. That just seems like it's too high a number. And I went and I informally did my own calculations on that, and it's possibly pretty close. Maybe at least 70% could be prevented if we took better care of ourselves.
Which is still a pretty large number.
A pretty high number.
That's more than two-thirds of the country.
I mean, that's two-thirds of... that's close to two-thirds of, or I mean, that is more than two-thirds of chronic disease or cancer. And of course, the question is, would that lead to longer lives? That would probably lead to greater longevity. We are not ever going to be immortal. But what I like to say is it will help you to live happier, longer, and most importantly, with less disability. And that disability certainly could come from both mental and physical health problems.
So then, since this self-care is so important as a preventative method to mental health issues, what other behavioral methods or preventative methods should we as a country either focus on to try to prevent some of these issues or the problems with maybe suicide or so do any of those things correlate?
That's a really difficult question. One of the things that I think is interesting looking forward is to think of how we might deal with mental health on a public health level. Now, to be honest, improved self-care is a public health measure, but you have to have people participate in it. What kinds of things can we put into place as a society which would improve mental health? I mean, let's give some examples of things which have been extreme public health victories. Sanitation, putting folate into bread supplies, fortification with iron. Calcium, fluoride. I mean, we've implemented a number of public health measures in the past, which have had remarkable effects on, say, dental health and bone health and prevention of infectious diseases. What kinds of public health measures might we be able to implement that will ultimately result in a marked improvement in mental health? And I don't know exactly what those will look like, but I presume that ultimately the most effective measures for mental health care will come from public health measures. And we're yet to see a lot of that yet.
that was always around by Third World. This is Local Talk on 89.1 KHOI Story County. I am your host, Saquon Gatlin, and we've been hearing from Dr. Carver Nebbe speaking on health concerns related to high-profile suicides and the relationship between self-care and mental health. Thank you for tuning in. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. Once again, that is 1-800-273-8255. If you feel as if someone is not safe or if someone may just need someone to talk to, that would be the place to go to. Last Tuesday, City Council held an important meeting discussing the rental cap agreement and rezoning Lincoln Way. We want to make sure everyone is well informed of the city's decisions. Therefore, Councilwoman Bronwyn Beatty Hansen joins me in the studio. Thank you for coming in this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right. Now, you wanted to discuss sustainability and some events that are coming up in July as well, but let's discuss the City Council meeting first. What is the update on the rental cap?
Yes, we had our meeting on June 26th, and we moved forward with the rental cap, which we've been talking about since the beginning of the year. And we had the first reading on hardship options, too, for the rental cap. So the concept there, if you're not familiar, is that we are limiting the number of rental permits. We call them letters of compliance, or LOCs for short. Limiting those in near-campus neighborhoods to 25%. Many of those neighborhoods are already over 25%. So what this means, in effect, is that in a lot of those neighborhoods, no new rental permits will be issued. And so that will kind of change the market, how homes are valued in that area. We've seen a number of years of them being converted to rentals, in near campus neighborhoods. So this will certainly change how that works. The hardship thing that we had our first reading of, and that was, criteria we came up with to allow people to obtain a permit if either they were in a hardship where they couldn't sell their home due to its proximity to rentals, or we also did give folks who are living in those areas one last chance to get a rental permit if they currently own their home there. And so that was kind of a controversial issue, the fact that we'd give folks one last chance to get a rental permit. But I think we set the bar pretty high. We put a pretty tight time limit on those rental permits. If they do want to get one, they have to come into compliance within 6 months of application. And that can be spendy for folks. So I think it should limit the number of new rental permits we see in that area. But that was a big deal.
Now, can people still get rental permits, or what is the length of time that they have to get those?
Good question. So we just did the first reading of the hardship exceptions. So we have two more readings to go until they're official, but if they pass in their current form, it would allow current homeowners, if they'd owned their home since October of last year, so before the moratorium, they have until September 1st to apply for a letter of compliance or a rental permit, we call it. And so, yeah, any current homeowner has a few months to apply, but then they have 6 months after they apply to bring the property up to compliance. And like I said, that can be spendy because to have a rental permit, your house has to have certain things met. You have to have fire extinguishers and fire smoke detectors, and you have to have railings on your stairwells, and you have to have, there's quite a lot of criteria you have to meet for that rental permit. So they have 6 months then to get the house to compliance, and then they have to actually rent it within a year to keep their rental permit. So the concept is we don't want a current homeowner getting a rental permit and hanging on to it for 5 or 10 years before they actually use it. So those are the criteria there. But it's a big deal to get this done. We've been working on it since the beginning of the year, and it's really held up a lot of our other regular business, really. This was something that we had to do because of some decisions at the state level last year. So it kind of was put on our table at the last minute. So I'm excited to get back to our regularly scheduled programming of work. I think that'll be good, too.
And we'll discuss that pretty soon.
Yeah.
But you also had more information on the rezoning of Lincoln Way. I know we had Kelly Diekman in last weekend speaking about that. But you have some more information about that?
Yeah, just that we moved ahead with the standards. So we had the third reading of our standards for that area, and we did amend the map, too. So we have a final map And we have final standards, and those will be going into place. And that is that really, the Lincoln Way rezoning, you know, I get a lot of questions about it because we see yard signs, you know, don't rezone Lincoln Way and things like that. For me, I really see this rezoning as a vision for the future. It's nothing that's going to change overnight. We're not going to see Lincoln Way from Grand to Duff there transforming, you know, within the next year or two, but hopefully a decades-long process, it'll kind of come into fruition for what we envision, which is an area with more residential density, you know, better walkability and bikeability to downtown. And the idea is to build a core of folks who want to, you know, be in the downtown area, you know, shop down there and really take advantage of the entertainment in the downtown area. So I'm excited to see that zoning in place. And it, too, is one that has taken a lot of our time. So
now it's not on the city to, create the new businesses or do anything of that nature. It's just was creating the new zoning laws or so.
Right, exactly. We just define the zoning. We're not looking to, the city itself is certainly not looking to acquire properties or land or anything like that. That's all in the private sector. So folks who own businesses in those areas who might want to sell, some developer out there is probably going to keep their eye open for that and look at those as they become available. But the city's role is really to define the zoning and then also offer incentives, I suppose, you know, tax abatements and things like that for redevelopments that really hit the goal we're going for.
Yeah. So those were the two big things that's been on the city's plate of recent times has been the rental cap agreement and the rezoning of Lincoln Way. Now that those are approaching the final decisions, what else does the city have planned that's coming up in the future, near future?
Yeah, good question. Well, we have one big project and a lot of fun, smaller projects too. The big one is what we call our comprehensive plan. And that is a plan that we'll build over the next few years that will replace our old land use policy plan that tells us, you know, what land to use for what type of development as the city grows. The comprehensive plan will replace that, so it'll be a land use policy plan, but it'll also encompass all the different policies that guide our growth and development in the city. And so that has been in the works. I thought we would be farther into it by now, but I think the rental stuff has kind of delayed that process. So looking forward to getting back into that. It's out for, we'll get a request back for a proposal for a consultant on that comprehensive plan here soon. And then another thing I'm excited about, we heard at the last council meeting from the sustainability coordinator that we'll be getting a report on waste diversion back in, we'll be getting that back in July of this year. And so I'm looking forward to seeing that because I think, you know, as far as sustainability goes, how we deal with waste here in Ames is a topic that that we can delve into deeper. Right now, you know, we send a lot of it to the resource recovery plant where they turn refuse into fuel. But with the conversion to natural gas at those power plants, we've found it more difficult to use the RDF, the fuel we get from that. And so I think as time goes on and with that new natural gas system, we'll have to look at other ways we can help the waste stream. So composting, maybe taking biological matter out of the waste stream would be a good start. And so I'm excited to see what the report says about what we can do there.
Awesome. Now that does sound fairly interesting to see what's going to happen. Because this is looking for the long-term future of the waste here. So is there any other specifics that they have discussed on what they will do for waste diversion or?
No, although, you know, I have some guesses. You know, the thing that we've discovered with the resource recovery plant and natural gas burning is that the plastics, when you burn those, they're great fuel, usually plastic. But it's creating a lot of acid that eats away at the towers, where it's burned. And so, you know, I don't know what the city will decide, but I wonder myself if maybe some, you know, long-term recycling program for certain types of materials, you know, maybe something we would consider. Yeah, it is interesting, and especially right now with the tower, you know, the damage to the towers from the acids and the plastic and things like that. Currently, from what I understand, garbage is backed up. So we're, you know, when the resource recovery plant isn't working, Ames does landfill its garbage over in Boone, and I think a lot of residents maybe don't realize that or don't know, aren't aware of when that's happening. You know, that we are landfilling instead of burning it.
Wow. And can you explain more of the problem then with landfilling instead of burning?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, if you can imagine, you know, if a citizen is thinking, oh, all this is going to be burned, you know, I'll throw it in my garbage, they're maybe throwing stuff in there like metals or batteries, things like that, that would normally get pulled out at the resource recovery plant, you know, through the recycling process. They have some magnets and things like that that pulls out metal and recycles it. Well, if that gets landfilled instead, you know, we're taking a limited resource we've got, like metal, and we're encapsulating it in the ground, you know, and we can't get that back. So in that way, I think, you know, landfilling is never the most desirable option because you're putting all your material in the ground never to be seen again. And you need space to do that, of course, too. So
now, is there anything that we as consumers can do instead to divert that issue? Maybe like have different types of trash, you know, or recycling or so, possibly for our metals or anything like that? Or what else could we do instead?
Good question. There are private recycling servicers out there. So a lot of the folks that do waste hauling also do recycling pickup. So that is an option for folks that they can sign, you know, they can pay for another service to come and pick up recycling too. The city does have glass dumpsters around town. Hopefully everybody knows about those. There's one at Fairway. There's one behind Wheatsfield. They're listed on the city's website. But glass, of course, is not a good fuel for burning anyway, and also not good, not useful to landfill. So people can separate their glass and they can take it to one of those yellow dumpsters that the city provides, and that would be a good start. And then personal composting too, I suppose, if people, aren't doing that yet, and if they want to get involved in that, you know, learning how to get a home composting operation going would be a good way to go too.
Awesome. And we are in the month of July, so this is the first Monday that we have in July. You had wanted to speak about some of the events that are going on in this month. What did you have to share with us?
Well, we've got a number of events in July. Coming up soon here, we have the 4th of July celebrations. On the 3rd of July in the evening are the fireworks in Ames. So just like to mention that in case folks are hoping for them on the 4th, but they are the 3rd. And then on the 4th, we've got our city council and mayor's pancake breakfast. So starting at 8:30, you can get free pancakes right in front of City Hall there. Council members and the mayor and city staff will be serving pancakes and beverages, things like that. And then we have the parade starting at 11 downtown, so that'll be fun.
Now, where does the parade actually go around or so downtown? Is it just specifically on Main Street, or where does it go around from?
Yeah, it goes down Main Street, and then they take a left on Douglas right here, and then they take another left on 5th Street. So it just kind of wraps around Main Street to 5th Street and then back.
All right. So, well, those are two things that, or a few things that you can do on the 3rd and the 4th to celebrate the holidays. What else do we have coming up in the month?
Well, we've got RAGBRAI coming too, which is exciting. And that will be on the 24th of July. That comes into town. And so that'll be exciting, you know, both a caution for residents to take extra time when they need to be getting places on the 24th, because we're going to be busy, a lot of extra people in town. But also it's fun, a fun event to just be present for and watch. And so I would encourage folks to get out there and just check out the fun. We also do have a lot of volunteering opportunities. So if people do want to get involved in volunteering, they should go to amesragbrai.com, which is the website we've got up for RAGBRAI while it's in town here, and you can find volunteering opportunities there. So We have that event coming up. And then back to sustainability, actually, we have the Rummage Rampage running from the 27th of July till the 2nd of August. And that's an event where we collect household, like, furniture or household goods, small household items, from people who would maybe normally throw them on the curb, or, you know, normally those would be going in the waste stream, or but we collect them, and then we have a big sale, and people can come check out what there is to buy, and it's a good way, like I said, to keep those items out of the waste stream, out of the landfill and things like that. And it's a very successful event. I think it's at least the third annual, if not more, and we've grown it every year. So it's right during that time where everybody's moving out, and, you know, normally there'd be a lot of piles on the curb. Hopefully we can get some of those in one centralized location.
Awesome. That was Councilwoman Brownwyn Beattie Hansen providing us with an update on the city's council's plans with the rental cap agreement, rezoning Lincoln Way, and more. Where can viewers find more information about the city's decisions and events coming up in July?
Well, you can always check out the city's website, which is cityofames.org. And then, like I said, for RAGBRAI, Ames RAGBRAI.
Awesome. Well, thank you for joining me this morning. Once again, that was Councilwoman Brownwyn Beattie Hansen.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Local Talk. I have been your host, Saquon Gatlin. Thank you for listening. KHOI would like to thank all of today's guests and contributors for making this show possible. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Remember, you can also hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also, remember, KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.